His awareness that he was carrying out an assignment of huge importance, that the survival of the whole Metro was in his hands, and that this mission hadn't been entrusted to him by chance, served as his support. Consciously or not, Artyom looked for proof in everything that he had chosen for carrying out this mission. But not like Hunter, but someone or something greater. To destroy the Dark Ones, to save his home station and those near and dear from them, and to stop the destruction of the Metro, that was his task. And everything that had happened to Artyom during his travels proved only one thing. He was not the same as everyone. Something special had been intended for him. He was supposed to make mincemeat of and destroy the vermin, which otherwise would make short work of the remnants of mankind. While he was walking along this path, faithfully interpreting the signs being sent his way, his will for success was overcoming reality, playing with statistical probability, warding off bullets, blinding monsters and enemies, and compelling allies to be at the right location at the right time. How else could he understand why Daniel had turned over to him the plan of the missile unit's location, and this unit, by some miracle, had not been destroyed decades ago? How else to explain that against all common sense, he had met one of the few, maybe only, living missile men in the whole Metro? Had Providence placed powerful weapons into Artyom's hands personally and sent him a man to help deliver a death blow to the inexplicable and merciless force crushing it? How else could all the miraculous rescues of Artyom from the most desperate situations be explained? While he believed in his own predestination, he was invulnerable, although people who accompanied him perished one after the other. Artyom's thoughts turned to what had been said by Sergei Andreevich Apolyanka about fate. At that time, those words had driven him forward like a new lubricated spring installed in the worn-out, corroded mechanism of a wind-up toy. But at the same time, they were unpleasant for him. Maybe it was because this theory deprived Artyom of his own free will and forced him to submit to the storyline of his own fate. But on the other hand, how was it possible for him to refute the existence of this line of thinking after everything that had happened to him? He could no longer believe that his whole life was only a succession of random events. Too much already had happened, and it was impossible to get out of this rut just like that. If he had gone so far, then he had to go even further. Such was the inexorable logic of the path chosen. Now it was already too late to hold any doubts. He must go forward, even if this meant bearing the responsibility not only for his own life, but also for the lives of others. All the sacrifices had not been in vain. He was obligated to take his path to the end. That was his fate. Just how had he lacked this clarity earlier? He had doubted his own election, distracted by stupidity and hesitating all this time, but the answer always was right there. Ullman had been right. There's no need to complicate life. Artyom was walking now, briskly beating out the pace. And he hadn't heard any noise from the pipes. Nothing dangerous had been encountered at all in the tunnels all the way to Vedienka. However, Artyom had come across people who were going to Prospekt Mir. He was moving against the flow of those unfortunates who were exhausted, had cast off everything, and were running from the danger. They viewed him as a madman. He alone was walking into the lair of terror itself, at the same time the others were trying to abandon the cursed place. There were no patrols at Ryshkaya or at Alexeyevskaya. Immersing himself in his thoughts, Artyom didn't notice when he had approached Vedienka, though not less than an hour and a half had passed. Climbing into the station and looking around, he unwillingly shuddered. How much it reminded him of that Vedienka he saw in his nightmares. Half the lighting was not working. There was the odor of burning gunpowder in the air, and somewhere in the distance were heard the moans and the anguished crying of women. Artyom held the machine gun at the ready and moved ahead, carefully skirting the arches and examining the shadows closely. It was as if the Dark Ones had been able, at least once, to penetrate the fences and reach the station itself. Some of the tents had been cleared away, and in several places there were dried traces of blood on the floor. People were still living here and there, and a flashlight sometimes even shone through the canvas. Distant gunfire could be heard from the northern tunnel. The exit to it was covered with bags of dirt, piled as high as a man. Three men were pressed against this breastwork, observing the tunnel through gun slots and keeping the approaches in their sights.
"Artyom, Artyom, where did you come from?"
a familiar voice hailed him. Turning around, he noticed Kirill, one of the men he had left Fedyenko with at the very beginning of his journey. Kirill's arm was in a sling, and the hair on his head seemed even more unkempt than usual.
"Well, I've come back," Artyom answered vaguely. "How are you holding out here? Where's Uncle Sasha? Where's Zhenka?"
"Zhenka? He was caught. They killed him a week ago,"
Kirill said gloomily. Artyom's heart fell.
"And my stepfather?"
"Sukhoi is alive and well. He's in charge. He's in the infirmary right now."
Kirill waved a hand in the direction of the staircase leading to a new exit from the station.
"Thanks."
Artyom raced away.
"And just where have you been?"
Kirill cried after him. The infirmary was sinister. There weren't many real wounded here, only five men. Other patients occupied the majority of the space. Diapered like infants and confined in sleeping bags, they were laid out in a row. All of them had their eyes wide open and they mumbled incoherently through their half-open mouths. It wasn't a nurse watching over them, but a rifleman holding a file with chloroform in his hands. From time to time, one of those in diapers began to fidget along the floor, howling and transferring his agitation to the rest, and then the guard would place a rag soaked with chloroform to the man's face. The man didn't fall asleep, nor did he close his eyes, but he went quiet for some time and calmed down. Artyom didn't see Sukhoi straight away. He was sitting in the office discussing something with the station doctor. Leaving, he ran into Artyom and was stupefied.
"You're alive. Artyomka, alive. Thank God. Artyom!"
he had begun to mutter, touching Artyom on the shoulder as if wishing to convince himself that Artyom was indeed standing in front of him. Artyom embraced him, and he, like a child, was afraid in the depths of his soul that he would return to the station and his stepfather would begin to scold him. He would say, "Where did you disappear to? How irresponsible? How long were you going to behave like a little boy?" But instead, Sukhoi just held him close and didn't let go for a long time. When the fatherly embrace finally ended, Artyom saw that Sukhoi's eyes were filled with tears, and he blushed. Briefly, he told his stepfather where he had disappeared to and what he had managed to do during that time, and he explained why he had returned. Sukhoi only shook his head and criticized Hunter. Then he came to his senses, saying that he would not speak ill of the dead, though he didn't know what had happened to Hunter.
"Do you see what's going on here?" Sukhoi's voice again hardened. "Every night they pour in, and there aren't enough bullets. A handcar arrived from Prospect Mir with supplies, but it's peanuts."
"They want to blow up the tunnel at Prospect Mir to cut off both Vedyenka and the other stations completely,"
Artyom reported. "Yes, they are afraid of the groundwater. They aren't venturing close to Vedyenka, but this won't help for long. The Dark Ones will find other entrances."
"When will you be leaving here? There's only a little time left, less than a day. You have to get everything ready."
His stepfather took a long look at him as if checking him over.
"No, Artyom. I only have one way out of here, and it's not to Prospect Mir. We have 30 wounded men here. What are we to do with them? Throw them away? And who will maintain the defenses while I am saving my hide? How can I go up to a man and say to him, 'Well, you are staying here so that you can hold them off and die, but I'm going?' No."
He took a breath.
"Let them blow it up. We'll hold out as long as we can. I have to die like a man."
"Then I'll stay with you," Artyom said. "They have the missiles, and they will manage without me. What's my purpose anyway? At least I'll help you."
"No, no, you must go,"
Sukhoi interrupted him. "We have a fully operational pressurized gate, and the escalator is working again. You can make your way to the exit quickly.
You must go with the others. They don't even know what they're dealing with.
Artyom suspected that his stepfather was sending him away from the station just to save his life. He tried to object, but Sukhoi didn't want to hear anything.
Only you alone in your group know how the Dark Ones are able to drive people mad.
He pointed at the diapered wounded.
What's wrong with them?
They were in the tunnels. They couldn't hold out. We managed to drag these out, and that's good. But the Dark Ones tore so many apart while they were alive. Incredible strength. The main thing is, when they approach and begin to howl, there are few who can stand it. You understand that? Our volunteers handcuffed themselves together so they wouldn't run away. But those who managed to get loose are lying here. There are only a few wounded, because if the Dark Ones reach you, it's hard to get away.
Zhenka? Did they get him?
Artyom asked, swallowing. Sukhoi nodded. Artyom decided not to get the details.
Let's go while there's a lull.
Taking advantage of his silence, Sukhoi added, We'll have a chat and drink some tea. We still have some left. Are you hungry? His stepfather embraced him and moved into the command room. Artyom looked around in amazement. He could not believe that in the weeks since he had left that Berdyenko had managed to change so much. The once comfortable, home-like station had now been cast into anguish and despair. He wanted to flee from here as soon as possible. A machine gun clattered behind him. Artyom gripped his weapon.
That's a warning, Sukhoi said. The most terrible time will start in a few hours. I feel it already. The Dark Ones come in waves, and we have killed only one recently. Never fear. If something serious begins, our guys will use the siren. They sound a general alarm.
Artyom pondered. His dream of walking into the tunnel. Now it was impossible. And a real meeting with a Dark One would hardly end just as harmlessly. There was no point in mentioning it when Sukhoi would never allow him to go into the tunnel alone. He had to reject such a mad idea. He had more important things to do.
I knew that you and I would see each other again. That you would come, Sukhoi said, pouring the tea once they were in the command room. A man arrived here a week ago looking for you.
What man?
Artyom was put on his guard.
He said you and he are acquainted. Tall, skinny, with a small beard. He had a strange name, similar to Hunter's.
Khan?
Artyom was surprised.
That's it. He told me that you would come back here again, and was so certain that I was put at ease at once. And he also gave me something for you.
Sukhoi reached for the wallet in which he kept notes and objects known only to him, and pulled out a sheet of paper folded a couple of times. Unfolding the paper, Artyom lifted it to his eyes. It was a short note. The words written in a sloppy, fleeting hand baffled him. He who is brave and patient enough to peer into the darkness his whole life will be first to see a flicker of light in it.
And didn't he give you anything else?
Artyom asked with a puzzled look.
No, replied Sukhoi. I thought it was a coded message.
But the man had come here especially for this. Artyom shrugged his shoulders. Half of everything Khan had said and done seemed complete nonsense to him, but on the other hand, the other half had compelled him to look at the world otherwise. How was he to know to which part this note pertained? They drank tea and chatted for quite a while. Artyom was unable to throw off the feeling that he was seeing his stepfather for the last time, and it was as if he was trying to talk long enough with him to last him for the rest of his life. Then the time to leave arrived. Sukhoi tugged the handle, and with a grinding sound, the heavy cover lifted a meter. Stagnant rainwater poured down from outside. Standing in slime up to his ankles, Artyom smiled at Sukhoi, though the tears were welling up in his eyes. He was at the point of saying goodbye when at the last moment he remembered the most important thing. Withdrawing the children's book from his rucksack, he opened it to the page with the photograph inside and handed it to his stepfather. His heart began to beat anxiously.
What is it?
Sukhoi was surprised.
Do you recognize her?
Artyom asked hopefully.
Look closer. Isn't this my mother? You would have seen her when she gave me away to you.
Artyom, Sukhoi smiled sadly. I hardly saw her face. It was very dark there and I was looking at a rat. I don't remember her at all. I remember how you then grabbed my hand and didn't cry at all, and then she was gone. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Bye. Artyom was on the verge of saying, Daddy, but a lump got caught in his throat. Maybe we'll meet again. He tightened his gas mask, bent over, slipped beneath the curtain, and ran up along the rickety steps of the escalator, carefully pressing the crumpled photograph to his breast. The escalator seemed simply endless. One had to climb it slowly and very carefully. The steps creaked and chattered beneath his feet, and in one place they unexpectedly moved downwards, and Artyom barely managed to yank away his foot. Moss-covered remnants of huge branches and small saplings were scattered everywhere, carried here by the explosion, perhaps. The walls were overgrown with bindweed and moss, and through holes in the plastic covering of the side barriers, the rusty parts of the mechanism could be seen. He didn't once glance back. Everything was black up above. That was a bad sign. Suddenly, he thought, what if the station pavilion crumbled and he couldn't overcome the obstacle? If it were just a moonless night, it wouldn't be too bad, but it wouldn't be easy guiding the fire of the missile battery in poor visibility. The closer to the end of the escalator, the brighter the glares on the walls and the thin beams penetrating the slits became. The exit to the exterior pavilion was blocked, not by stones but by fallen trees. After several minutes of searching, Artyom discovered a narrow trap door through which he could just about squeeze. A huge gap, almost the length of the whole ceiling, yawned in the roof of the vestibule through which the pale lunar light fell. The floor was covered with broken branches and even with whole trees. Artyom noted several strange objects next to one of the walls, large, dark gray leather spheres as tall as a man, rolling in the brush. They looked repulsive, and Artyom was afraid to go any closer to them. Switching off his flashlight, he exited onto the street. The upper station vestibule stood among an accumulation of the expanded frames of once graceful merchants' pavilions and kiosks. Ahead he could see an enormous building. It was strangely bent, and one of the wings was half demolished. Artyom looked around. Ulman and his comrade were not around. They must have been delayed along the way. He had a little time left to study the surroundings. Chapter 20. Born to Creep. After catching his breath for a minute, he listened, trying to detect the heart-rending howl of the Dark Ones. The botanical gardens were not far from here, and Artyom couldn't understand why these beasts had not reached their station along the surface before now. Everything was quiet, but somewhere in the distance wild dogs howled sadly. Artyom didn't want to run into them. If they'd managed to survive on the surface all these years, something must have distinguished them from the dogs the Metro residents kept. Moving a little further away from the entrance to the station, he discovered something strange. A shallow, crudely dug trench encircled the pavilion. A stagnant, dark liquid filled it, as if it were a tiny moat. Jumping the trench, Artyom approached one of the kiosks and looked inside. It was completely empty. On the floor was broken glass. Everything else had been taken. He investigated several other kiosks until he stumbled onto one which promised to be more interesting than the others. Outwardly, it resembled a tiny fortress. It was a cube welded from thick sheets of iron with a tiny window made of plate glass. A sign over the window read, "Currency Exchange." The door was secured with an unusual lock. It wasn't opened with a key, but with the correct digital combination. Approaching the little window, Artyom tried to open it, but he couldn't. He noticed some faded handwriting on the windowsill. Forgetting the danger, Artyom turned on his flashlight. It looked as if whoever had written it had been left-handed, but he was able to read the uneven letters. It said, "Bury me the human way, code 767. And as soon as he understood what it might mean, an angry chirr was heard overhead. Artyom recognized the sound right away.
The flying monsters above Kalininsky had cried exactly like that. He hastily put out the flashlight, but was too late. He heard the call again, directly above him. Artyom desperately looked around, searching for somewhere to hide. He decided to try the numbers written on the windowsill, pressing the buttons with the digits in the necessary sequence. He pulled the handle toward him. He'd been right. A dull click was heard inside the lock, and the door gave with difficulty, creaking on its rusty hinges. Artyom wriggled inside, locked himself in, and again turned on his light. In a corner, resting with its back to the wall, sat the shriveled mummy of a woman. It was squeezing a thick felt-tip pen in one hand and in the other a plastic bottle. The walls were covered with neat female handwriting from top to bottom. An empty tin of pills, bright chocolate wrappers, and soda cans lay on the floor, and in a corner stood a half-open safe. Artyom wasn't afraid of the corpse. He felt only pity for the unknown girl. For some reason he was sure that it was a girl. The cry of the flying beast was heard once more, and then a powerful blow on the roof shook the kiosk. Artyom fell to the floor, waiting. The attack was not repeated, and the squeals of the creature began to grow more distant, so he decided to stand up. When it came down to it, he was able to hide as long as he liked in his shelter. The girl's corpse had not been disturbed all this time, though certainly enough hunters had feasted on those around it. Of course, he might have been able to kill the monster, but he would have had to go outside, and if he missed or the beast turned out to be armored, a second chance wouldn't present itself. It was more reasonable to wait for Ullmann, if he was still alive. Artyom began to read the handwriting on the walls to pass the time. "I write because I am bored and so I don't go insane. I've been sitting in this stall for 3 days already and I'm afraid to go outside. I have seen 10 people who were not able to run into the metro. They suffocated and are lying right in the middle of the street even now. It's good that I managed to read in the paper how to glue adhesive tape to the seams. I will wait until the wind carries the cloud away. They wrote that there won't be any more danger after a day. 9th of July. I tried reaching the metro. Some kind of iron wall starts beyond the escalator. I wasn't able to lift it, and no matter how much I beat on it, no one opened it. I started feeling really bad after 10 minutes, so I came back here. There are many dead around. Everything is horrible. They are all swollen up and they smell. I broke the glass in a grocery stall and took the chocolate and mineral water. Now I won't starve to death. I have felt terribly weak. I have a safe full of dollars and rubles and nothing to do with them. That's strange. It turns out they're only bits of paper. 10th of July. They have continued bombing. An awful roar was heard all day to the right from Prospekt Mir. I thought no one was left, but yesterday a tank passed at a high speed. I wanted to run out and attract their attention, but I couldn't. I really miss Mom and Lieva. I've been throwing up all day. Later I fell asleep. 11th of July. A horribly burnt man has passed by. I don't know where he has been hiding all this time. He was forever crying and wheezing. It was really awful. He went toward the metro, then I heard a loud bang. Most likely he was knocking on that wall, too. Then everything went quiet. Tomorrow, I'll go and take a look and see whether they opened it for him or not. A new blow shook the booth. The monster wasn't giving up on its catch. Artyom staggered and nearly fell on the dead body, barely able to hold himself up by grabbing onto the counter. Bending down, he waited another minute, then continued reading. 12th of July. I'm not able to leave. I'm shivering. I don't understand whether I'm sleeping or not. I was talking to Lieva for an hour today, and he said he will marry me soon. Then Mom arrived, and her eyes were flowing. Then I was left alone again. I'm so lonely. When it all ends, will they rescue us? Some dogs are here and are eating the corpses. Finally, thank you. I have been throwing up. 13th of July, there's still some canned food, chocolate and mineral water, but I don't want it anymore. It'll be another year before life returns to normal. The Great Patriotic War went on for 5 years. Nothing can be longer. Everything will be okay.
They will find me. 14th of July. I don't want it anymore. I don't want it anymore. Bury me the human way. I don't want to be in this damned iron box. It's cramped. Thanks for the vonazepam. Good night. Alongside was some more handwriting, but ever more incoherent and ragged, and drawings, imps, young girls in large hats or bows, human faces. Obviously she was hoping that the nightmare that she survived would soon be over, Artyom thought. A year or two and everything would come full circle. Everything would be as it was before. Life would go on and everyone would forget about what had happened. How many years have passed since then? Mankind has only further distanced itself from returning to the surface during this time. Did she dream that only those who managed to get down into the metro would survive? Artyom thought about himself. He'd always wanted to believe that once people were able to get out of the metro in order to live again as they had before, they would be able to restore the majestic buildings erected by their ancestors and settle down in them so as not to squint at the rising sun and to breathe not the tasteless mixture of oxygen and nitrogen filtered by gas masks, but to swallow with delight the air suffused with the fragrances of plants. He didn't know how they smelled before, but it was supposed to be wonderful. His mother had reminisced about flowers. But looking at the shriveled body of the unknown girl who didn't live to see the cherished day when her nightmare ended, he began to doubt that he would. How did his hope to see the return of a previous life differ from hers? During the years of existence in the metro, man had not amassed the strength to climb the steps of the shining escalator leading to his past glory and splendor in triumph. On the contrary, he was reduced, becoming used to the darkness. Most people had already forgotten the absolute authority mankind once had over the world. Others pined for it, and a third group cursed it. A horn sounded from outside, and Artyom threw himself to the window. A very unusual vehicle stood on a patch of ground in front of the kiosks. He had seen automobiles before, in his distant childhood, then in pictures and photographs, in books, and finally during his previous climb to the surface. But not one of them looked like this. The huge six-wheeled truck was painted red. Behind its cab, which had two rows of seats, the metal body of the truck had a white line along the side and some pipes piled on the roof. Two rotating blue lights blinked. Instead of struggling out of the booth, he shone his flashlight through the glass, waiting for an answering signal. The truck's headlights flashed on and off several times, but Artyom was unable to leave the kiosk. Two huge shadows were diving headlong one after the other. The first grabbed the roof of the truck with its talons and was trying to lift the vehicle up, but it was too heavy. Lifting the vehicle's body a half meter from the ground, the monster tore off both pipes, squealed with displeasure, and dropped them. The second creature struck the automobile in the side with a screech, counting on turning it over. A door swung open, and a man in a protective suit jumped to the asphalt with a bulky machine gun in his hands. Lifting the barrel, he waited several seconds, evidently allowing the monster to come closer, and then let loose a spray of bullets. Offended churring was heard from overhead. Artyom hastily opened the lock and ran outside. One of the winged monsters was describing a wide circle about 30 meters above their heads, preparing to strike again, but the other couldn't be seen anywhere.
"Get in the vehicle!"
yelled the man with the machine gun. Artyom raced towards it, scrambled into the cab, and sat on the long seat. The machine gunner let off a burst of shot several more times, then jumped onto the footboard, slid into the cab, and slammed the door behind him. The vehicle roared off.
"You feeding the pigeons?"
Old man hooted, looking at Artyom through his gas mask. Artyom thought that the flying beasts would pursue them, but instead, having flown past about another 100 meters behind the vehicle, the creatures turned back towards Vedienka.
"They are defending a nest," the fighter said. "We've heard about that. They would not just have attacked the vehicle like that. They aren't big enough. Where is it, I wonder?"
Artyom suddenly understood where the monsters had their nest, and why not one living thing, including the Dark Ones, dared be seen next to the exit from Fedayencha.
"Right in our station's hall, above the escalators," he said.
"Is that so?" "Strange. Usually they are high, or they nest on buildings," the fighter replied. "Most likely it's another type. Right. Sorry we're late."
It turned out to be rather cramped in the suits, and with the bulky weapons in the vehicle's cab.
The rear seats were occupied by some rucksacks and cases. Ullman had taken the outside seat, Artyom had ended up in the center, and left of him behind the wheel sat Pavel, Ullman's friend from Prospekt Mir.
"What's that to excuse? It wasn't on purpose," the driver said. "Something the colonel didn't warn us about. We had the impression a steamroller had passed over the street that runs from Prospekt Mir to Ryshkaya. Why that bridge hasn't collapsed, I don't know. There wasn't anywhere to hide. We barely got away from some dogs."
"Haven't you seen any dogs yet?" Ullman asked.
"I only heard them," Artyom responded.
"Well, we had a good look at them,"
Pavel said, turning the wheel.
"What about them?"
Artyom was interested in learning from him.
"It wasn't anything good. They tore off the bumper and nearly gnawed through the wheel, even though we were moving. They only stopped when Petro took out the leader with the sniper rifle."
He nodded at Ullman. It wasn't easy going. The ground was covered with trenches and holes. The asphalt was cracked, and they had to make their way carefully. In one place they got stuck, and it took about 5 minutes to cross a mountain of concrete rubble left from a collapsed bridge. Artyom looked out the window, squeezing the machine gun in his hands.
"It's going okay,"
Pavel was talking about the vehicle.
"Where did you find it?" Artyom asked.
"At the depot, in pieces. They weren't able to fix it, so it couldn't go to fires while Moscow was burning down. Now we use it from time to time. Not for what it was built for, of course."
"Got you."
Artyom again turned towards the window.
"We've been lucky with the weather."
Pavel, it seemed, wanted to talk.
"There's not a cloud in the sky. That's good. We'll be able to see a long way from the tower, if it turns out we reach it."
"I'd rather be up there than walking from house to house," nodded Ullman.
"True. The colonel was saying that almost no one lives in them, but I don't like the word almost."
The vehicle turned left and rolled along a straight, broad street, divided in two by a plot of grass. On the left was a row of almost undamaged brick homes. On the right stretched a gloomy black forest. Powerful roots covered the roadway in several places, and they had to go round them. But Artyom managed to see all this only in passing.
"Look at it, what a beauty,"
Pavel said with admiration. Straight ahead of them, the Ostankino Tower supported the sky, rising like a gigantic club threatening enemies brought down long ago. It was a perfectly fantastic structure. Artyom had never seen anything like it, even in the pictures in books and magazines. His stepfather, of course, had told him about some cyclopean structure located only 2 kilometers from their station. But Artyom hadn't been able to imagine how it would astound him. For the rest of the way, his mouth was open in surprise, and he stared at the grandiose silhouette of the tower, devouring it with his eyes. His delight at seeing this creation of human hands was mixed with the bitterness of finally understanding that nothing like it ever would be created again.
"It has been so close all this time, and I didn't even know,"
he tried to express his feelings.
"If you don't come to the surface, there's much you will not understand in this life,"
Pavel responded.
"Do you at least know why your station is named what it is? Vedienche? It means great achievements of our economy, that's what. There was a huge park there with all kinds of animals and plants. And this is what I am telling you. You are really lucky that the birdies spun their nest right at the entrance to your station. Because some of these structures have been softened so much by the X-rays, now they can't even sustain a direct hit from a grenade launcher."
"But they respect your feathered friends," Ullman added.
"It is, so to say, your roof."
Both men began to laugh, and Artyom, who couldn't be bothered to set Pavel straight regarding the name of his station, stared once more at the tower. He noticed that the enormous structure had leaned a little, but it seemed to have attained a delicate balance and hadn't fallen. How in hell could something put here decades ago remain standing? Neighboring houses had been swept away, but the tower proudly rose among this devastation, as if it had been magically preserved from the enemy's bombs and missiles.
"It's interesting how it has survived," Artyom muttered.
"They didn't want to demolish it, most likely,"
Pavel said.
"Anyhow, it's a valuable infrastructure. It was 25% higher, you know, and there was a pointed spire on top. But now you see it's broken off almost right at the observation deck."
"But why spare it? Didn't they really care anymore? Well, I suppose that it might not have gone well with the Kremlin."
Ullman was doubtful. Sweeping through the gate behind the steel rods of the fence, the vehicle approached the very foundation of the television tower and stopped. Ullman, took the night vision instrument and the machine gun and jumped to the ground. A minute later, he gave the go-ahead. Everything was quiet. Pavel also crawled out of the cab and, having opened the rear door, undertook dragging out the rucksacks with the equipment.
There should be a signal in 20 minutes, he said. We'll try to catch it from here.
Ullmann found the rucksack with the radio transmitter and began to assemble a long-field antenna from the multiple sections. Soon the radio antenna reached 6 meters in height and lazily swung to and fro in the slight breeze. Sitting at the transmitter, the fighter put the headset with the microphone to his head and began to listen for a transmission. Long minutes of waiting wore on. The shadow of a pterodactyl covered them for an instant, but after describing a few circles over their heads, the monster disappeared behind the houses. Apparently one encounter with armed people had been enough for it to remember a dangerous enemy.
And what do they look like anyhow, these dark ones? You're our specialist on that,
Pavel asked Artyom.
They look very scary, like people inside out,
Ullmann was trying to describe them.
The complete opposite of a human. And it's clear from the name itself, the dark ones. They're black.
You don't say. And where did they come from? No one even heard of them before, you know? What do they say about that?
It doesn't matter what you never heard of in the metro. Artyom hastened to change the subject. Who from Parpobyedy knew anything about the cannibals?
That's true, the driver brightened up.
They found people with needles in their neck, but no one was able to say who had done it. What nonsense the great worm is. But this is where these dark ones of yours are from.
I have seen him. Artyom interrupted him.
The worm?
Pavel asked, not believing him.
Well, something like it. A train, maybe. Huge. It bellows so that you block your ears. I didn't manage to see what happened. It tore right past me. No, it couldn't be a train. What would power it, eh? Mushrooms? Trains are driven by electricity. You know what it reminds me of? A drilling rig.
Why? Artyom was taken aback. He had heard about drilling rigs, but the idea that the great worm who had gnawed the new passages about which Dron had spoken may turn out to be such a machine hadn't occurred to him. And wasn't all belief in the worm built on denying machines?
Don't say anything to Ullmann about the drilling rig. And the colonel, too. They'll all think I'm nuts,
Pavel said.
The thing is, I had been gathering information at police earlier. I tracked down every plainclothes detective, and in short, I was involved with subversives and the internal threat. And one day an old guy ran into me, and he was convinced that in one recess, in a tunnel next to Borovitskaya, a noise was constantly heard, as if a drilling machine was operating behind the wall. Of course, I would have immediately determined he was insane, but previously he had been a builder and knew a lot about such things. But who would need to dig there? No idea. The old man raved on that some miscreants wanted to dig a tunnel through to the river so that all police could bathe, and he had somehow overheard their plans. I immediately gave a warning, only no one believed me. I rushed to look for this old man in order to present him as a witness, but he, as luck would have it, had got lost somewhere. An agent provocateur, maybe. And maybe,
Pavel looked carefully at Ullmann and lowered his voice,
he really heard how the military are digging something secret, and they buried my old man at the same time. Since then I have had ideas about the drilling rig, and they are putting me down as a nutcase. It's hardly worth saying that they begin to taunt me straight off about the rig.
He went quiet, looking searchingly at Artyom. What was his attitude to his story? Artyom vaguely shrugged his shoulders.
Not a damn thing heard. Empty air, the approaching Ullmann spat angrily. We can't get it from here, son of a bitch. We have to get higher. Melnik most likely is too far away.
Artyom and Pavel immediately started picking up. No one wanted to think about other explanations for why the Stalker's team hadn't made contact. Ullmann folded the antenna into sections, put the radio into the rucksack, lifted his machine gun onto his shoulder, and walked off first, toward the glass vestibule that was concealed behind the television tower's mighty pillars. Pavel handed one case to Artyom, took the knapsack and rifle himself, cracked the vehicle's doors, and they followed Ullmann. Inside it was quiet, dirty, and empty. People apparently once ran from here in a hurry and never returned again. The moon surprisingly shone through the broken dusty glass onto overturned benches and the broken counter of the ticket office, onto the security post with the remnants of a service cap forgotten in haste, onto the broken turnstiles at the entrance, and illuminated stenciled instructions and cautions for visitors to the television tower. They turned off their flashlights and, looking around a little, found the exit to the staircase. The useless elevators that had been able to take people up in less than a minute stood on the first floor with their doors flung feebly open. Now the team was approaching the most difficult area. Ullman explained that they had to get to a height of more than 300 meters. Artyom did the first 200 steps with ease. Weeks of traveling around the metro had toughened his legs. He began to flag at 350. The winding staircase stretched upwards, and there was no perceptible difference between the floors. It was damp and cold inside the tower, and apart from naked concrete walls, all that could be seen was abandoned equipment rooms through the occasional open door. Ullman decided to take the first break after 500 steps, but he took only 5 minutes to rest. He was afraid of missing the moment when the stalker tried to communicate with them. Artyom lost count after the 800th step. His legs were filled with lead, and each one now weighed 3 times as much as at the beginning of the climb. Lifting his foot off the floor became very difficult. The floor pulled it back like a magnet. Perspiration flooded his eyes, and the gray walls floated, as if in a fog, and the insidious steps began to clutch at his boots. He was not able to stop and rest. Behind him, panting, was Pavel, who was carrying twice as much as Artyom. After about 15 more minutes, Ullman again allowed them to take a break. Even he looked tired. His chest heaved heavily under the shapeless protective suit, and his hand rummaged along the wall in search of a support. Pulling a canteen with water from the knapsack, the fighter first extended it to Artyom. A special valve was provided in the gas mask, through which a catheter passed. One was able to suck water through it. Artyom understood that the others wanted a drink, but he was unable to tear himself away from the rubber tube until the canteen was half empty. Afterwards, he settled to the floor and closed his eyes.
"Come on, it's not much further,"
Ullman shouted. He jerked Artyom to his feet, took the case from him, loaded it onto his own shoulders, and moved forward. Artyom didn't remember how long the final part of the climb took. The steps and walls merged into one dull hole. Beams and spots of light from behind dull stains on the viewing glass looked like radiant clouds, and for some time he was distracted by the fact that he was admiring their iridescent tints. The blood pounded in his head, the cold air tore his lungs, and the staircase went on forever. Artyom sat down on the floor several times, but they picked him up and forced him to walk. Why was he doing this? So that life could continue in the metro? Right. So that they could grow mushrooms and pigs at Fedienche in the future, and so that his stepfather and Jenkina's family lived there in peace, so that people unknown to him could settle at Alexeyevskaya and at Ryskaya, and so that the uneasy bustle of trade at Bieloruskaya didn't die away, so that the Brahmins could stroll about Polis in their robes and rustle the pages of books, grasping the ancient knowledge and passing it on to subsequent generations, so that the fascists could build their Reich, capturing racial enemies and torturing them to death, and so that the worm people could spirit away strangers' children and eat adults, and so that the woman at Mayakovskaya could bargain with her young son in the future, earning herself and him some bread, so that the rat races at Paveletskaya didn't end, and the fighters of the Revolutionary Brigade could continue their assaults on fascists and their funny dialectical arguments, and so that thousands of people throughout the whole metro could breathe, eat, love one another, give life to their children, defecate and sleep, dream, fight, kill, be ravished and betrayed, philosophize and hate, and so that each could believe in his own paradise and his own hell, so that life in the metro, senseless and useless, exalted and filled with light, dirty and seething, endlessly diverse, so miraculous and fine, could continue. He thought about this, and it was as if a huge crank turned in his back and nudged him to take one more step, and another, and still another. Thanks to that, he continued to move his feet. And suddenly, it all ended. They tumbled into a spacious area, a broad, circular corridor, a closed ring. Its inner wall was faced with marble, and Artyom at once felt as if he were at home. and there was an outer wall. The sky began immediately behind the completely transparent outer wall, and somewhere far, far below were strewn tiny little homes, split into neighborhoods by roads and patches of parks, and there were huge black craters and the rectangles of surviving tall buildings. The whole boundless city, like a gray mass moving toward the dark horizon, could be seen from here. Artyom got down onto the floor, leaning against the wall, and he looked for a very long time at Moscow, and the sky slowly turning pink.
Artyom, get up, that's enough sitting. Come, give us a hand.
Ullman shook him by the shoulder. The fighter handed him a large bundle of wire, and Artyom stared at it blankly.
This damned antenna won't pick up anything.
Ullman pointed at the twisted 6-meter probe scattered on the floor. We'll try the loop. Over there's a door to the engineering balcony, a floor below us. The exit is right there on the botanical garden side. I'll stay here with the radio. You go outside with Pashka. He'll uncoil the antenna, you secure it. Be lively, 'cause it will start to get light soon.
Artyom nodded. He remembered why he was here, and he got a second wind. Someone had tightened that invisible crank in his back, and that inner spring began once more to unwind. Only a short while remained to the goal. He took the spool and moved towards the balcony door. The door didn't give, and Ullman had to fire a whole salvo into it before the glass, riddled by his bullets, cracked and spilled out. A powerful gust of wind almost knocked them off their feet. Artyom stepped onto a balcony enclosed by a grate the height of a man.
Wow, look at them! Pavel extended the field binoculars to him and waved his hand in the appropriate direction. Artyom pressed the binoculars to his eyes and looked over the city until Pavel pointed him in the right direction. The botanical gardens and Vedienka coalesced into one dark, impassable thicket, among which rose the peeling white cupolas and roofs of the exhibition's pavilions. Only two gaps were left in this dense forest, a narrow path between the main pavilions. Glavnaya Aleya, Pavel whispered timidly, and this. A huge patch had formed right in the middle of the gardens, as if even the trees had drawn back in disgust from an unseen evil. It was a strange and repulsive sight, a large city like a gigantic life-giving organ, pulsing and quivering, that stretched out for several square kilometers. The sky gradually was being painted with morning colors, and this terrible tumor was becoming ever more visible. A living membrane entangled with veins, tiny black figures crawling out of cesspool exits, running about in a businesslike way, like ants. Ants especially, and their mother city reminded Artyom of an enormous ant hill. And one was walking away from the paths. He saw it well now, towards a white round structure standing on its own, an exact copy of the entrance to the Vedienka station. The black figure reached the doors and disappeared. Artyom knew the route all too well. They really were right next door, and hadn't come from some remote place. And it would be possible to really destroy them, simply destroy them. Now the main thing was that Melnik didn't fail. Artyom heaved a sigh of relief. For some reason he was reminded of the black tunnel from his dreams, but he shook his head and set about unwinding the cable. The balcony encircled the tower, but the 40-meter wire wasn't enough to go right round. Tying off the end to the grate, they went back in.
I have it! There's a signal!
Ullman began to yell cheerfully on seeing them.
We have comms! The colonel is turning the air blue. He's asking where we were earlier.
He was pressing the headphones to his head, listened some more, and added,
he says everything is even better than we had thought. They found 4 installations, all in excellent condition. They had been preserved in oil beneath the tarpaulin. He says Anton is a hero. He's familiar with it all. They'll be ready soon. We have to report the coordinates. He sends you greetings, Artyom.
Pavel unfolded the large map of the area that had been divided into quarters, and looking through the binoculars, began to dictate the coordinates. Ullman repeated them into the microphone of his radio.
We'll seal out the station itself, too, in any case.
The fighter consulted the map and called out several more digits.
That's all. They've got the coordinates. Now they'll do the aiming.
Ullman removed the earphones and rubbed his forehead.
It'll still take some time. Your missile man there is the only one who knows how. But that's nothing. We'll wait.
Artyom took the binoculars and again went out onto the balcony. Something had dragged him to this disgusting anthill. Some oppressive feeling. An intangible and inexpressible anguish, like something heavy pressing on his chest. not allowing him to breathe deeply. The black tunnel once more rose up before his eyes, and suddenly it was clear, distinct, as Artyom had not seen it even in the nightmares that had pursued him relentlessly. But now it was possible not to be afraid. These vampires didn't have long to lord it in his dreams.
"That's all. It's taken off. The colonel says wait for the greeting. Now we're going to fry these black bitches of yours,"
Ullmann yelled. And at that moment the city beneath their feet vanished. The sky disappeared into a dark abyss. The happy cries behind his back abated, and there remained only one empty black tunnel along which Artyom had strolled so many times. For what? The time thickened and congealed. He pulled a plastic lighter from his pocket and struck the flint. A small, happy flame jumped out and began to dance on the wick, illuminating the space around it. Artyom knew what he would see and understood that now he must not fear it, and therefore he simply lifted his head and looked at the huge black eyes without whites and pupils, and he heard it.
"You are the Chosen One."
The world had been turned upside down. In those unfathomable eyes he suddenly saw, in a fraction of a second, the answer to everything that had for him been left incomprehensible and inexplicable. The answer to all his doubts, hesitations, and searches. And the answer turned out not to be what Artyom had been expecting. Having disappeared into the gaze of the Dark One, he suddenly saw the universe with its eyes. New life was being reborn, and hundreds and thousands of individual minds were being joined together into a single whole. The resilient black skin allowed the Dark One to endure both the scorching sun and the January frosts. The soft telepathic tentacles enabled it to caress any creation and to painfully sting an enemy, and it was totally immune to pain. The Dark Ones were the true inheritors of the ruined universe, a phoenix that had risen from the ashes of mankind, and they possessed a mind, inquisitive, living, but completely unlike the human mind. But somehow, it connected with him, with Artyom. He saw people with the eyes of the Dark Ones, embittered, living beneath the earth, talking back with fire and lead, destroying the bearers of the flag of truce who had been sent to them with a song of peace. And they had wrested the white flag from them and stabbed them in the throat with the shaft. Artyom understood the growing despair at the inability to establish contact and to reach a mutual understanding, because in the depths, in the lower passages, sat unreasonable, infuriated creatures who had destroyed their own world, who continued to bicker among themselves, and who would die out soon if no one could re-educate them. The Dark Ones were extending a helping hand to people, and again the people seized it with hatred. He saw the desire to rid themselves of these embittered but very clever creations. But he also saw the desperate searches to find one of the unfortunates, one who would become a bridge between the two worlds, who could explain to the people that there was nothing to fear, and who could help the Dark Ones communicate with them. He understood that there was nothing dividing people and the Dark Ones. He understood that they were not competing for survival, but were two organisms intended by nature to work together. And together, with man's technical knowledge and with the ability of the Dark Ones to overcome perils, they could take mankind to a new level, and the world, having ground to a halt, could continue to rotate about its axis. Because the Dark Ones were also part of mankind, a new branch of it, born here in the ruins of a megalopolis swept away by war. The Dark Ones were the consequence of the final war. They were the children of this world, better adapted for the new terms of the game. And they sensed man not only with their customary organs, but also with tentacles of consciousness. Artyom recalled the mysterious noise in the pipes. He recalled the savages who could cast a spell with only a glance, and the revolting mass in the heart of the Kremlin that could assault one's reason. Man had not been able to cope with their influence on the mind, but it was as if the Dark Ones were created for it. Only they needed a partner, an ally, a friend. someone who could help establish communications with their deaf and blind elder brothers. And so began the long, patient search for an intermediary, a search crowned with luck and delight, because such an interpreter, the Chosen One, had been found. But before contact had been established with him, he disappeared. The tentacles of the commoner looked for him everywhere, sometimes grabbing him in order to begin discourse, but he, afraid, tore away and ran. But he had to be supported and rescued, stopped, warned of the danger, urged on, and again taken home where communication with him would be especially strong and clear. Finally, contact could become established, and then the Chosen One could take another step towards understanding his mission, his fate. He had been intended for this because he had opened the door to the Metro, to the people, and to the Dark Ones. Artyom briefly thought about asking what had happened to Hunter, but this thought began to whirl in the vortex of new improbable sensations, and it vanished into the seething whirlpool of experiences and disappeared without a trace. Now nothing distracted him from his primary goal, and he once again opened his mind to their mind. He now stood on the threshold of something incredibly important. He had experienced this feeling at the very beginning of his odyssey when he was sitting next to the bonfire at Alexeyevskaya, and it was this clear understanding that kilometers of tunnels and weeks of wandering had led him to a secret door, and knowing that opening it would give him access to all the secrets of the universe and allow him to tower over the wretched people gouging out their world in the unyielding, frozen earth. His long trip was forcing Artyom to throw the door open and bathe in the light of absolute knowledge that would gush out. And let the light blind him. Eyes were a clumsy and purposeless instrument, suitable only for those who have not seen anything in their life except the sooty arches of the tunnels and the filthy granite of the stations. Artyom now had to extend his hand towards the one offered to him. Though it was frightening, it was undoubtedly friendly. And then the door would be opened, and everything would be different. Unseen new horizons spread before him, beautiful and majestic. Joy and determination filled his heart, and there was only a drop of remorse that he had not understood all this earlier, that he had driven away his friends and brothers. He grabbed the door's handle and pulled it down. The hearts of thousands of Dark Ones far below were ignited with joy and hope. The darkness before his eyes dissipated, and putting the binoculars to his eyes, he saw that hundreds of black figures on the distant ground had stopped still. It seemed to him that all of them now were looking at him, not believing that the so long-awaited miracle had occurred, and the senseless, fratricidal hostility had come to an end. At this second, the first missile drew a fiery, smoky trail in the sky with lightning speed and struck the very center of the city, and immediately three more of the very same meteors streaked across the reddening sky. Artyom jerked back, hoping that the salvo could still be stopped. But he suddenly understood that everything was already over. An orange flame swept over the anthill. A pitch-black cloud shot upwards, new explosions circled him from all sides, and the city crashed down, emitting a tired, dying moan. It was clouded by the thick smoke of the burning forest. From the sky, more missiles fell, and each death reverberated with a melancholy pain in Artyom's soul. He tried desperately to discover in his consciousness at least a trace of that presence which just had filled and warmed him, and which had promised salvation for him and all mankind, which had given meaning to his existence. But nothing was left of it. His consciousness was like a deserted metro tunnel. Artyom keenly felt that the light by which he would be able to illuminate his life and find his way would never appear again.
"We really gave it to them, eh? They'll know not to bother us."
Old man was rubbing his hands.
"Artyom?" Artyom.
The whole botanical gardens and Fedyenka were turning into one fiery mass. Huge puffs of fatty black smoke lazily lifted into the